to call to order the House Interim Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. We are in session. We have a very extensive agenda this afternoon, and I think one that promises to be extremely interesting. I note by the number of folks in the audience that we have items that are of general interest to the public as well. We're going to get underway straight away. Our first item that we're going to be addressing today is the sage-grouse conservation partnership, and I'd like to ask up first, please, Brent Brownscombe and Don Davis.
Wow, I didn't even recognize you.
And supporting roles.
And there's another one.
If you'll have it.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Brett Brownscombe, policy advisor to Governor Kitzhaber on natural resources. Thank you for the invitation to be here.
Absolutely.
To talk about a big issue with a lot of big implications that really affect the whole state, but are often talked about more on one portion of the state, specifically roughly one-third of the state, so a sizable area in southeast Oregon where sage-grouse reside, but with ripples around a future Endangered Species Act review that has implications for interest statewide, and I'll touch on that. What I wanted to do was give a broad, big-picture overview of the issue and then hand off to Department of Fish and Wildlife, to Kurt and Don, for a bit of sage-grouse biology 101 and a little bit of discussion of the threats to the bird and what's happening at the local level to address some of those threats. And then I know we have other panelists as well. So without further ado, the framing of this issue is really there is an Endangered Species Act listing review. In 2010, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service listed the sage-grouse, greater sage-grouse, as warranted but precluded from listing. So warranted for biological reasons because of species decline, but precluded for other reasons, and committed to, based on a court order, reviewing that decision in 2015, in the fall of 2015. So based on that, we have, along with 11 other western states, Oregon is in a position where we're in a portion of the range of the bird, the Great Basin, along with Nevada, Idaho, and parts of Utah, where we're looking at a species that has a high sensitivity to disturbance, that has had population declines in a part of the state where our rural communities and economies are already stressed to a far higher degree than other parts of the state. And our objective as a state is to come up with a state plan that puts Oregon in a position to either have averted an ESA listing or position us in a place where the state maintains authorities over programs and management that's tied to its economic future and social future, that gives us the flexibility and authorities that we need to maintain the state's position in management. And we're doing this through a partnership called SageCon. SageCon is the broader table, and I know we have some folks here who traveled from a good distance to, including Don, to represent their voices on that table. That's a table that's been convened with the BLM and NRCS, because what we're doing in Oregon is needing to partner up what we do on the state level with what BLM's doing on the roughly, I'll be wrong on the portion, but the majority of the range of the sage-grouse is public domain land, BLM land. We're working on an all-lands, all-threats plan approach that addresses the threats to the species while maintaining and advancing the economic and social vitality of rural eastern Oregon. We're walking this line knowing that we have a 2015 Endangered Species Act listing review. So the scepter of this is by some referred to as the spotted owl of the prairie. So what's at stake here is not just the conservation future of the bird, which is important for a variety of reasons, including recreation, whether it be hunting or the habitat that the bird resides in being important to a variety of other species. It's also very important to interests including renewable energy development, mining, livestock grazing and ranch farming and ranching, and the rural communities that are tied closely to this habitat and operations on both the public land and the private land where sage-grouse reside. So, rolling into the threats in Oregon, there is a conservation and opportunities threats report that was worked on by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service scientists along with state biologists from the 11 western states within the range of the bird. That report basically outlines across the range of the bird and then dials down into different states like Oregon, what are the key threats and what are the key areas where conservation opportunities exist to roll back some of those threats. This is important because given that the 2010 decision was warranted but precluded under the Endangered Species Act, we essentially have to demonstrate that what the state has done between now and the time of the 2015 listing review is peeled back or addressed the key threats to the bird to a degree adequate to be able to demonstrate that those threats are no longer going to create continued population declines for the species and that will instead stabilize over time the populations and put them on an upward trajectory. The key threats for Oregon are what I wanted to touch on here and maybe we'll get into later. We're really looking at in the portion of the range for this bird, and this isn't just Oregon but other surrounding states, wildfire and invasive species including juniper and annual grasses like cheatgrass and medusa head are really the primary threats to the bird. Past and potential future habitat fragmentation is a future concern, but in terms of the largest scale of the threats, we're really looking at things that are natural forces on the land, some of which are very hard to control. Where we can control certain threats, though, this is on the development front. This is where, relative to other states, what I wanted to set out here, and we may get into this more in questions and answers because the state is... I was just with Commissioner Nichols from Harney County, and we've talked about this on the phone. The state and county planners and the counties themselves, we're in discussions now about where do we go with the threats that relate to things that are more within our grasp of controlling through existing systems. And so we have a land use planning system in Oregon that positions us as a state relatively well compared to other states in the range of the bird because of the work of the counties through our land use planning program. We haven't seen the sprawl or encroachment into key areas of sagegrass habitat that other states have. It's not to say it's never happened or that there's no risk from it, but we're in a relatively better position. And what this boils down to is in Oregon, we have an existing policy which is tied to core areas being the best of the best. So when we talk about this, and I'll ask Kurt and Don to get a little bit more into ODFMW's existing sagegrass conservation strategy, there are areas on the landscape that biologically are the most important for protecting. What we're trying to do with our state plan is steer future development away from those areas and into areas where the risks of the bird are far less. The current approach that we have is, under state policy, is avoidance of core altogether. What we're trying to get through the SAGECOM process and the state plan is to a more flexible yet scientifically defensible policy that recognizes, yes, the approaches try to avoid CORE with development. Where it can't happen, though, and this is a reflection of Senate Bill 3086, which Representative Vance had a key hand in advancing. We're looking at a disturbance and mitigation approach that recognizes flexibility for development to happen, even if it touches CORE, but ensuring that it happens within a context of net conservation benefit to the bird. So we feel like we can get there, and this is where the plan is focusing. The other very important portions of the plan that are going to be key issues when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service looks at what has Oregon done with its plan are fire and invasives. So this is the other component of the plan. We're working on actions and having conversations with SageCon partner groups around how do we come up with prioritized approaches to dealing with fire? Where would we want to make sure that we don't, if at all possible, have future fire, especially in those core areas? So how do we really work on the take advantage of the infrastructure we have in a lot of the rural communities, which many people in urban communities don't know about, with rural fire protection associations, where these are boots on the ground, these are people who know the land well and can really be helpful with initial attack. They can, in a prioritized way, get to fires first in most cases. So we're looking at that as a way to strategically address fire, figuring out where would we want to prioritize suppression first, and then how do we build resources and strategies around making sure that approach happens. On invasive species, and that includes juniper and annual grasses, the prioritized approach there is let's figure out what we have. I mean, where do we know we've got invasion of native sagebrush and plant communities to a degree that is fairly high, and if it's in some cases so high that the habitat's just not there for the bird anymore, maybe that's not the highest priority. Instead, maybe we shift. What we're looking at is mapping out where are juniper encroaching, and same with annual grasses, encroaching upon core areas of habitat that are key to sagegrass population vitality, and trying to focus effort there with treatment, so juniper removal and invasive grass, both inventories and treatment. All of this is going to cost money, so we're looking at both through the governor's budget as well as conversations with the SageCon partners. How do we move money around and build money around a prioritized approach to dealing with some of these threats that don't really lend themselves to regulatory approaches? On other threats, and I wanted to mention this, and I think others will get into it, Oregon's also in a good place related to livestock grazing. This has been a flashpoint issue around litigation. The sagegrass issue in terms of the listing decision in 2015 is almost certain to be litigated one or the other. Oregon is positioning itself as best as we can within that context. And I think thanks to the good proactive work of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association as well as soil and water conservation districts like Harney County SWCD, we have in place there a candidate conservation agreement with assurances, which is signed by both the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as well as the conservation district, where landowners can sign up, manage their ground to the standards in these candidate conservation agreements, and basically put land use, sign agreements and put land use management plans in place that will provide them the assurance that they are protected from Endangered Species Act implications if they manage those standards. It's a really proactive approach. It's one where other counties across the state and their soil and water conservation districts are engaged with Harney County as a leader in advancing that model to those places relative to other western states. Oregon is leading on that front. So we have a lot that we've done since the warranted but precluded decision in 2010 that we can stand on. We have, including the CCAA, we have other issues that we need to continue to focus on, both in terms of proactive voluntary conservation measures as well as assurances that the kind of development that other states may have seen or be seeing won't happen in Oregon. And we have a land use system that ensures that, and we have some assurances in terms of backstops that we can provide to make sure that when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service reviews the status of the bird, we've satisfied that and provided that assurance. It's not like we're seeing a huge increase in wind development, which has to do with a variety of factors, or solar development. Should markets change and should that kind of economic opportunity start to expand, we feel like we can, through the sage-grouse planning effort, plan for that proactively in ways that work for the bird. But there are assurances around a backstop that it's not so much existing uses on the ground, such as agriculture or grazing, but for new potential uses that may be unanticipated at this point, we need to assure that they won't happen in a way that puts the bird at risk of continued population decline. So overall, that's where the state stands. We're looking at a fall time period for the release of a draft of our plan. There's a lot of interest. I'm going to wrap it up here. A lot of interest in the issue, because it's not, in the end, just about 7-plus Eastern Oregon counties. It's about the future of the economic vitality of rural communities in the state. It's about the status of a bird that has iconic Western value, and of its habitat that has value to a lot of people who hunt, hike, birdwatch across all the state. And it's about the vitality of industries that aren't just, that are not only in the range of the bird, including livestock and agriculture, but also industries that are very vital to the other portions of the state, including Portland, with renewable energy. And so we have representatives from those interests here today. I'll turn it over to Kurt, you and Don, to touch a little bit more on the basics of why this issue is such an issue for this particular species and where the state is on conservation planning.
And Kurt, before you start in, Brett, I want to accommodate your schedule. If you need to leave earlier than the conclusion of this panel, I'd offer our committee the opportunity to ask you questions now if you need to leave. If you have some time, I prefer to hold the questions until the panel is over with. So I don't know what your time commitment is here.
I'm good until 3 o'clock at least, so long as...
Don't ever tell anybody that in this building. All right, fine. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon to talk about sage-grouse. I do offer apologies for the agenda change. Mr. Rickerson was originally on the agenda. He had some eye surgery earlier in the week and was not able to return to work as originally planned. So you got me and Don.
All right.
Excellent. But I do appreciate the opportunity to be here. I did want to make a few comments and then turn it over to Don related or for some discussion relative to, as Brett put it, to sage-grouse biology 101. You know, we're fortunate in Oregon to have a pretty large segment of intact shrub steppe habitat, primarily in the southeast corner of the state, a little bit up north there as well. As a result of that intact habitat, we have really in our, you know, we're perhaps biased, but we really believe we have one of the sage-grouse strongholds on the west, in the west coast as well, with a population of birds between 25 and 30,000 annually. We have a long history of working with the producers in a voluntary nature to improve and enhance sage-grouse populations long before they were considered for listing, long before anybody was even talking about listing sage-grouse. We, our local staff in southeast Oregon, was working with the local producers, and many of them you've talked to before or will talk to later today, on a strictly voluntary basis, because they recognize their role in the conservation of the species long before there was any discussion of listings. And so we, and of course, again, continuing with the theme of being biased, being a state fish and wildlife agency, we like having authority over the state's fish and wildlife. We are working diligently to try and get authority, for instance, over cormorants or marine mammals that are both protected federally, so that we can exercise some local solutions to what we consider to be real problems, and which is one of the reasons that we're working very diligently to try and avoid a listing of sage grouse in Oregon. Not to mention, as Brett pointed out, the potential negative impacts to the local economies. So with that, I want to turn it over to Dawn. And Dawn, I think this is probably her first presentation at a legislative hearing. She's one of our set of boots on the ground, if you will, out in Southeast Oregon working on sage grouse, both at the policy level with the SageCon effort, but also on the ground with local producers on local projects as well. I want to turn it over to her to talk a little bit about sage grouse. As Brett mentioned, there are a lot of unique aspects to this bird, not to mention its size and the habitat that it's lived in, but its breeding behavior and affiliation for certain sites relative to annual breeding activities. But I want to turn that over to Dawn. She can wow you with all the...
And just a minute before you do, I know Brett had referenced the spotted owl here early on in his testimony. And just so that you could give this committee and the audience, the public, some kind of feel for the magnitude of the area that would be involved with any listing, could you give us some kind of comparison or rough guesstimate of how many acres or square miles might be involved in a listing?
I'm sure, Chair Witt. I think I can't give you specific square miles or acres, but I think in terms of scale, it's on the same scale as spotted owl listing in terms of the size of the total area of the state, surface area that would be affected. It's certainly comparable to spotted owl.
And Kurt, I apologize if I'm putting you on the spot, but there would be vast acreages, I presume, in other states as well that would be impacted by a listing.
Chair Witt, the listing, at least if they're listed across their entire range, would affect really all the western states.
All of the western states.
11 total.
Yeah.
11.
Well,
so this is very serious business here.
Absolutely. If you look at it in that context, not just it within the state of Oregon, it's obviously much larger than the spotted owl, because the spotted owl is confined really to Oregon, Washington, Northern California.
Thank you very much. And Dawn, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Representative Witt, and thank you to the committee for inviting me here today. My name is Dawn Davis. I'm the Sage Grouse Conservation Coordinator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I just wanted to give you just a bit of a background. As Brett mentioned, the Sage Grouse 101. Sage grouse are a sagebrush obligate species. So what that means is that they require sagebrush for all their life history needs. They're breeding in sagebrush, they're nesting, brood rearing, wintering, all within sagebrush habitats. And so that represents a significant portion of eastern Oregon. We are fortunate in eastern Oregon that the community has been very involved in both conservation and management. Despite those efforts, we have seen some declines in sage grouse numbers over the past few years. We believe much of that decline is related to weather conditions, primarily the drought that we've seen over the last few years. And we are still compiling the data from this year in order to develop a population estimate for 2014. But based on 2013, populations declined approximately 26% compared to 2012. Now, that seems to be a pretty significant drop, but when we look at our population goal of 30,000 birds, in 2013 we had a population of approximately 25,000 birds. And so we believe that even though we saw a decrease, that the numbers are still within what we would expect to see as natural variation or fluctuations from one year to the next. One thing we did see in 2012 was a decrease in production, or the number of chicks that were produced that year. The good news is, in 2013, we saw an extreme increase in the number of chicks that were produced by hens. And so our expectation for 2014 is that we will likely see an increase in numbers. And the birds are naturally cyclic, so we do expect to see some highs and lows in approximately over a 10-year period. And so we may not see a drastic change this year in an increase in numbers. One of the strategies during the breeding is that only one or two of the most dominant males do the majority of the breeding. And so as yearling males are coming onto these breeding sites, there might be a potential lag of approximately 1 year before we actually see an increase in numbers. We base our population numbers on LEC estimates, which is a count of the number of males that occur within a breeding season. And so if we do have some of these first-year males, we may not see those actually coming on and onto the LEC until a year from now. So between this year and next year, we can expect to hopefully see a population increase. One of the things that Brett mentioned were the threats in Oregon. And through the SageCon All Lands, All Threats process, we are looking at all the threats to sage grouse within Oregon, but we're really trying to focus on the three main threats and trying to develop a strategic approach to address wildfire, invasive species, and juniper encroachment. And so through the SageCon planning process, we do have two sub-teams that have been meeting and developing a strategy to effectively address those threats. We're beginning to identify areas and develop a risk assessment so that we can look at and see where the greatest risk occurs for both invasive species and wildfire so that we can strategically place our efforts. One of the things that we're also looking at, particularly related to wildfire, is developing a risk assessment, looking at where our resources are located, particularly resources for the rural fire protection agencies, identifying where gaps in those equipment may be. That way we can begin to identify areas where we need to designate additional resources, because the rural fire protection agencies are really the people that are the first ones on the ground and are an extremely valuable resource when it comes to fighting wildfire in eastern Oregon. And ultimately, what we would like to see is the involvement of the local implementation teams, because really these are the people that know their area and are on the ground, and through their involvement we can really begin to have a strategic approach to concentrating management and conservation efforts within eastern Oregon. With that, I think I might best represent ODFNW by being here to answer specific questions you might have related to the biology of the bird and any questions related to the threats or specific things that may be affecting habitat or sage grouse within Oregon.
Thank you very, very much. Certainly appreciate your testimony. I'm going to open this up for questions and comments by the committee and recognize that we have with us today Senator Witsa and Representative Bentz, who have offered to share their time and expertise in this area with our committee. So thank you both for your participation today. Questions or comments from the committee? Representative Bentz.
Mr. Chair, and thank you for inviting us to participate today. I wanted to thank the Governor's Office for its hard work and ODFNW also on this most important issue. I do think, in getting to my question, I want to focus a little bit on the size of the area that was impacted, because I think it's important that those here today understand maybe more clearly how big a deal this is. And I try to do this consistently in a lot of these hearings, so many of you have heard this before, but our state is almost tied for being the ninth largest state in the union, just a little under 100,000 square miles. About 40,000 of those square miles are affected by this activity. And I say that because the effect of the listing is to preclude many linear projects, power lines, fences, roads, other activities, and that infects the entire area within which the grouse may be listed, not just the core area where the listing occurs. So this listing will affect all of Harney County, not just the half of it that might constitute core habitat. That's terrifically important. So many might say, what is it that's within those 40,000 square miles? And the answer would be about 350,000 people. So this is going to affect 350,000 Oregonians, this listing, directly. So I think the alacrity with which the Governor's Office has attacked this problem is well taken, given the incredible impact it's going to have just on those within the area affected, not to mention the reverberations out from the listing should it occur. So I want to repeat it. About 40,000 square miles of the state's roughly 97,000 square mile landmass will be affected by this if it happens. And Brett, you and I have talked about having a succinct statement regarding what negative things happen to this state should the listing occur. We talked about this at the last meeting I attended in Burns. And it's critically important people understand what that is. It's not enough to say we're going to suffer the devastation that accompanied the owl. Most many people have forgotten. Let's tell everybody here what happens if the listing happens. What don't we get to do on that 40,000 square miles that we've taken for granted that we could do to this point? And what negative impacts on the future of Oregon should the listing occur? That's the question.
For me.
Yes. In, 30 seconds. And you know, folks, I shouldn't joke about this. This is a big deal. Yeah. So.
Yeah, Chair Witt, Representative Bentz. Representative Bentz is absolutely right. And I think I started my testimony by saying this is a big issue and a big deal, because you are absolutely right on in terms of the implications. In not just that range in those counties, but statewide. And I think other folks testifying today will touch on that. But to get at your question, Representative Bentz, it's unclear exactly what, in terms of the light switch on and off, what would change overnight with a listing, in terms of what no longer would be able to happen. But what is clear is the flexibility that the state has in the variety of its programs, whether it be related to energy facility siting, roads, at the private level and municipal level, development in local municipalities, and certainly on the livestock and agricultural level, those uses would all be subject to a whole different degree of management oversight than exists today. And that primarily comes with Section 7 and Section 9 of the Endangered Species Act, where consultations, anytime there's a nexus with the federal government, and on this issue there's a lot of nexus because of the, the amount of BLM managed land within the range of the bird, and relevant to the social and economic values of rural communities, and B, federal funding. Where there's that federal nexus, there is a consultation obligation with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, where anybody who is who touches that nexus would have to be doing consultations with the federal government that right now aren't happening. The other liability is Section 9, take liability for killing, injuring, or harassing a listed species, and the definitions of those various terms in law are all such that the reach can be fairly wide on what harassment means. And I would just stop there by saying there's a lot of complexity and uncertainty and risk relative to the status quo that a listing would impose. That's laid upon the ongoing threats or risks to the bird that a listing would ultimately be aimed at stopping. Our view is that through a state-based approach in working with the local counties on the threats that we can control, and then working with landowners and the federal agencies on those larger threats related to fire and invasive species, we can get to a place where we can leverage more funding and more benefit for the conservation of the bird that keeps the state out of that less flexible listed scenario. And that's where we're positioning as our A game. So I don't know if I've answered it entirely in the detail you want, Representative Bentz, but I think those are some of the ways that things would fundamentally change for those doing business in, living in, the part of the state where the bird exists.
Brett. Thank you. Mr. Chair, given restrictions on time, I won't do a follow-up. I'm guessing there's going to be a lot more questions. So
I suspect it will be Representative Bence, but I would appreciate your guesstimate of what might be up in terms of loss on those lands. And would it be fair to say that we would stand the risk at least of losing the opportunity to have any kind of economic development on those lands that would be up for listing?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving me the opportunity to respond to that question. I can answer it and then ask you, Brett, to critique the response. It struck me as I learned that two of my hospitals in my area may have to close as a result of not having sufficient volume of patients to remain open under the new reimbursement regimen. And it struck me that anything that happens in rural Oregon requires some degree of subsidization from the more wealthy parts of the state. The response has been, we need to find something that these areas can do to support themselves so they can continue to survive. When we have listings like this, that which would bring people to a rural area is prevented from happening, whether it's mining, whether it's ranching, whether it's solar development, whether it's geothermal development, whether it's anything that requires some sort of change to sage-grouse habitat. And so, or at least change that doesn't, change won't happen without an immense overlay of cost, studies, lawsuits, other things that come into play when these new regulatory structures are imposed. So the future of these rural areas, if we're going to have a future, is going to be dramatically constrained by a listing because of all the baggage, regulatory baggage that accompanies it. So the key to the understanding the consequence of this is the size. 40,000 square miles. It's bigger than 12 of our states. And suddenly that is taken off Oregon's economic table. What? No, that's why I so much appreciate the governor's efforts to try to head that off. And that's why working with you on the bill, we tried to design a doorway through that restriction should it occur. But let's hope it doesn't. Because we have learned that there may be rare earth minerals out across that 40,000 acres, or excuse me, square miles, and we may never be able to access those in times of national emergency or otherwise, just because of a listing, because we won't know they're there. And if they are, we couldn't get at them. So those kinds of things, that future would be dramatically dampened. And that's a really long answer to your question, Mr. Chair, but I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, Representative Bence, I appreciate very much your grounding us in the scope and the magnitude of this potential challenge that we're facing here. So thank you very much. Additional questions or comments for our panel? Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. You mentioned a 26% decline in the sage grouse, and I was wondering if this is computer modeled or what is your actual on-ground empirical statistical confidence level for that number?
We have a couple of different ways that we look at our population status each year. And so population numbers are based on annual let counts, which are the breeding display grounds of sage grouse. Males come to their breeding grounds annually each year and return to the same grounds each year, which allows us the opportunity to count the numbers and then track the fluctuations in population size. There is a lot of variability across years and the number of leks that we can observe, and so what we've done is establish a set of trend leks that are monitored every year, and we try to visit those leks at least three times during the course of the spring, and that allows us to develop a maximum number of males that observed on that lek. And then from that, we can extrapolate a population size, and we use information from harvested grouse and male and female sex ratios in order to extrapolate from the number of males we see to a total population size. And so we do have some confidence intervals within that. But there is, it's certainly not statistically rigorous, because there is some issues just because of the nature of where these leks occur. It's often very difficult to get to them. That adds to the variation in our counts. But it is a good assessment of trend, maybe not necessarily a good assessment of actual population numbers. And so it should be more so an evaluation of trend than actual birds.
Just follow up. Then how do you get 26%? That's a really precise number if you don't have a statistical confidence level that's based on actual observation. I mean, it's a very, you're not giving us a range, you're saying it's 26% decline.
Right, and that's just based on the population numbers from 2012 and 2013 based on those LEC counts. And so there is some variation within that, and I don't have the exact numbers, but we can demonstrate the actual variation. And as I mentioned, because of the fluctuations that we do see annually, we would expect to see the fluctuation we see was normal and within the range that we would expect.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rarely do you see a decline in anything to the degree that we have without taking a look at predators. In the case of fawns, antelope fawns some years back, 75% were being taken by coyotes. We knocked that population down, had an immediate salmon. Cormorants taking 50%, $250,000 a week of value from our hatchery system. Cougars and the steens knock that population down. When you talk about your threats, there is no doubt in my mind what we're looking at here. I've been out there for 50 years as state game enforcement officer, and I have my tree farm. I'm not certain I'm not the oldest person in the dining room anymore, like 74. There's some history that I've observed that we're reluctant to look at predation. And when we get all done going down these tracks, almost every time it leads us back to predation as a major factor. And I see that you've got fire, a juniper, encroachment, and what was the other one?
Invasive species.
Invasive species. But has there been any population evaluation on predators in the coarse sage-grouse areas?
There has been some limited work, particularly in Nevada, looking at the effects of raven density on nest success. And so I think we can all acknowledge that there has been a change in the type of predator communities we see, and we've seen an increase in raven abundance across the western U.S. A lot of the information that we do have is tied back to habitat, with the science suggesting that if the habitat is there, that does reduce the level of predators. Sage grouse are pretty low on the food chain. We expect that there would be a relatively high level of mortality on sage grouse due to predators. From the Fish and Wildlife Service perspective, they don't believe that predation has a population level effect. I think that in certain areas, particularly in areas where habitat may not be as suitable, or if there are areas of isolated populations, that predators may have an increased effect. But you see that on local scales rather than at a population or range-wide scale.
Please.
I don't mean to be cruel, but if you look for the federal Fish and Wildlife or the federal government to acknowledge anything that makes sense, you're wasting your career.
And Chair Wade and Representative Krieger, if I may follow up on that, the predator issue is something that has come up at the SageCon table. Folks have brought that to the table, and it is something that's being addressed in the plan. So the plan will not be silent, and the strategies for what to do about that threat won't be absent. It's, I think what Dawn got at the distinction between loss of habitat and loss of individual birds is one that that is important here. And if the habitat is lost, it's a lot harder for the birds to bounce back. Not saying that loss of individuals through predation is not a factor, but threats from fire and invasive species are at an acreage scale that is really significant. The predator issues that we're talking about dealing with through the state plan are, there is some evidence brought in by folks locally as to local areas where, whether it be corvids or other species, where you've got some known hot spots. And so that's the kind of thing that we're thinking about through the planning effort.
Just want to follow up. Yes. Looking at this issue, kind of in the western states, we talked about the basin, this main population that's there. So our part of it may be affected by one thing and another area by another. Do you know off the top of your head, I don't know if it was Utah or somewhere, has a plan to reduce raven populations? Do you know what that number is they're going to use? How many they're going to reduce it by?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, I don't know. I think you're correct that it's Utah. I know Nevada's
huge
also been
number,
talking about
I heard
this,
it the other day, but I can't recall it.
Yeah.
They're not doing that. And by the way, the service is going to allow them to do that.
That's right.
So they're acknowledging that in part of that habitat, that's a major factor, or they wouldn't be allowing it, because the pushback is, I imagine, quite great.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that, I believe that Assistant Director Melcher mentioned that there was 25,000 to 30,000 population, and then you turned around and said it was a loss of 26%, which means that population has dropped to around 22,000 to 18,000, somewhere in that area, depending upon whether it was 25 or 30,000. Which is a significant a drop, but you talked about drought being one of the issues. What are we going to do if we have another drought? And what steps have we taken? We talked about some issues here on predators and what a study in Nevada has to do with Oregon, I'm not real sure, because they're different states, different predators, maybe the same common predator, I don't know. But have we not studied what predators are actually doing to this population? Have we assigned a biologist to this to study predator, what a predator does to them? Have we done that?
There, to my knowledge, there have been no studies that are specific to predation. Oftentimes, when we do have studies, we note mortality of birds and try to assess what was the cause of mortality. Oftentimes, the time it takes for us to get the birds to the birds, it's very difficult to tell whether what caused the mortality of that individual. And so we do have some idea in certain segments of the population that address survival, but nothing specific to identifying predators or the relationship of predators and how they may be affecting populations.
So in other words, follow up, sir?
Yes, please.
In other words, we have a situation here where we're having a loss of 26% of a population of a wildlife animal here, and we're not really sure why. Is that what we're saying?
I would say that decrease was largely attributed to the lower production that also occurred during that year. Typically, you would like to see just over 2 chicks per hen in order to have a stable population. In 2012, we estimated 0.8 chicks per hen, so that's substantially lower than what we would like to see in order to have a stable population trend, and so that was related to nest success. Again, in 2013, we saw the number of chicks per hen rise to just above 2. And so that's, as I mentioned, why we do expect to see an increase, and that accounts for that annual variation we're seeing from year to year related to nest success and production. more so than other factors.
Well, then I would suggest, Deputy Melcher, that maybe we put some people on this. We have almost 200 biologists in this state, and so this is a very critical issue. We're talking 40% of our state that may be shut down, and we're out here fiddling a little bit while the building's on fire. And I think if we have almost 200 biologists in this state, we should have somebody on this to find out exactly what is the problem with this population, because this population, it could be very important. And I don't understand why we hunt them.
Right.
I mean, we've got a species that's almost endangered here, and we're still hunting this species. Now, you told me it was about 500 people put in for this tag or something like that, I think. Was that correct?
Chair Witt, Representative Escobar, I believe we have about 500 tags annually. There may be more than 500 people that apply for those
500
tags.
I
think right now, essentially, we're using upland game bird license dollars to fund our sage-grouse work, this very work that you're asking for and supporting. We don't use our upland game bird funds or hunting license funds for efforts on conservation efforts on species that are not hunted. So one of the key pieces of information that we get in terms of population monitoring is the results from the hunts. We get wings, we get an age and sex structure for the population, which is essential when your population estimates are based on long-term trend counts. You need to be able to have the sex ratio from your harvest as well as the age structure. And we're using hunting license dollars to do that work.
Yeah, I can appreciate that, Deputy Melcher, but the problem I have here is you're taking 1,000 birds out of a population of something that may be an endangered species, so you can do research to what? You haven't even done the research on the predator.
Chair Witt, Representative Escobar, it's not research in the pure form of, or in the pure definition of research. It's basically standard basic population monitoring that comes from our hunt information. Absent that,
well, you've got sex and okay, I understand that part, but what you're doing is you're gathering information at the expense of an animal that may be an endangered species.
We believe strongly that they're not and should not be listed. We believe we have a healthy population, one that can sustain these are really relatively small levels of harvest. We believe strongly that our population can support that, and we're advocating with the governor's office and others that these animals should not be listed under the Endangered Species Act.
But could we be a core for grouse recovery where we could take these birds and take them to the areas if we let that population expand and take those to different areas in different states?
Chair Witt, Representative Escobar, I'm not familiar whether other states are looking for sage grouse to transplant. Certainly other states have populations as well that they may or may not move around within their state. I mean, anything's possible, but that's not been the model that we've been pursuing. And like I said, I mean, I think the hunting community believes that there should be some very limited controlled hunting opportunity for these birds. And
well, then let me ask this question. What activity or activities should we be doing now in order to enhance this population and even let it grow? Because, you know, the biggest problem with a sage hen is it's dumber than a sack of hammers. I mean, that is the dumbest bird I've ever been involved with, because I mean, it stands there and looks at you. Everyone from Eastern Oregon's going, yeah, we understand that.
You know? I love you.
I mean, it's how I'm just concerned that we do not have the answer. You haven't shown me an answer yet of why, what predator or what real effect this has on this animal, and it may not be the hunting, but that may be part of it. It may be the predators, but we're not sure because we've never done a study on it. We've gotten information from Nevada, but that's in Nevada. That's not Oregon. We're talking about some juniper coming out and getting into the habitat area. We talk about drought. We talk about this. We talk about that. What 3 or 5 steps can we do to enhance this population? That's all I would like to have.
Chair Witt, Vice Chair.
And immediately, when are we going to start on it?
And on that, Chair Witt and Vice Chair Esquivel, we have, since 2010, and this is, I can get more detailed information to you, there have been a lot of actions taken by landowners to their credit and funded through partnerships like the NRCS Sagegrass Initiative, where juniper removal has happened, invasive species fence marking with flagging so the birds don't run into it. We've got data on, we certainly know what happens when juniper encroachment or other disturbance gets close enough to a lek, and when the birds will abandon it in terms of, there's a threshold there that, and it's a gradient, but it's a pretty steep threshold. So we know what has an effect in terms of holding on to what we've got. In terms of restoring things, there is data related to juniper work on what happens post-juniper removal. So I think those types of actions have proven beneficial. Your points are taken and certainly clearly received about put a biologist on the predation issue and that there's a an issue out there that is, there are populations within Oregon. There's not just one Oregon population. There are several populations within the state. And so some of the issues are population specific. For example, on the one thing that Don touched on regarding the decline that I want to be sure folks recall, and I know those who are out there recall it real well, there were well over 1 million acres that burned in 2012. And that's by acreage some of the largest fire activity in state history. And ODFW did put collars on birds following that fire to study what their response would be. And there's data from that indicates that those fires really did have a pretty significant effect. And so it gets back to this issue of how much do we focus on the habitat as the long-term driver of success here, even though it's going to be a slower march to progress in terms of recovering the types of habitat that the bird needs, versus how much do we stress actions that can help individuals by protecting them from, say, fire, for example, or preventing them from being hunted. And we're looking at that. It's not an either-or, but there is from a variety of scientists who have looked at this at the state level and the federal level, saying the real threats to the long-term viability of the species relate to the habitat. And not that you should ignore other things or do nothing, and other states have taken action on hunting restrictions. But the real focus should be on the habitat, and so that's when we take the message back in terms of how do we prioritize actions in the state plan to present to the Fish and Wildlife Service for its listing decision in 2015. That kind of a prioritization construct is what we're hearing from scientists at a variety of levels, state and federal.
Okay. One last thing.
But today, we understand that it's habitat because that's mule deer, elk, I mean, it's all in that mix.
Yeah.
But we really don't have a handle on the predators because we have no information on what those predators' effect is on this species. Correct?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, certainly many, many predators have an impact on sage grouse. And, you know, it runs the full range from coyotes, cougars,
ravens,
to ravens on the youngs or in terms of raiding nests, you know, before the eggs are even hatched. So full spectrum of potential predator impacts. It's, as Brett mentioned, it's part of the planning effort. We're certainly interested in that. We don't have all the answers right now. Absolutely not.
Thank you. I'm going to recognize Senator Witsa and then committee members. I'm going to have to move this agenda because we've got a very heavy schedule ahead of us.
I think, Chair Witt, I struggle with the concept that habitat is the limiting factor for the birds or the mule deer or whatever. I guess we burned 1 million acres 40% of Oregon is about 25 million acres, and most of that's in sagebrush. If you drive through Klamath Lake, Malheur, and Harney counties, there's a huge area out there. I think it almost borders on criminal not to look at the predators. As a large animal veterinarian, you know, I mean, the reason why the large animal veterinarians, food animal veterinarians are in that area is because that's where the food animals are. I can tell you, you know, could write you a history of at least three different situations where I've seen that every calf that was born on a calving ground after dark was killed by coyotes. These are cows, not birds. Coyotes love eggs. Ravens love eggs. Certainly the encroachment of juniper trees causes more perches for raptors and so forth. I mean, let's not deny it. But to me, this talk of loss of habitat is more of a straw man. I think you need to look for other primary causes for the reduction in these numbers. It's very difficult, again, when you drive across four counties, 16 million acres out there, and we're saying that we're somehow the birds don't have any place to roost. Borders on incredible. No question. Thank you.
At the risk of a revolt, I am going to recognize a couple more members of the committee. Vice Chair Frederick, please.
Thank you, Chair Witt. First of all, I'm a little surprised that you don't have the list that I was able to find just quickly Googling of the number of papers that have been done regarding the impact of raptors on sage grouse populations. Easily found several of them just by doing a quick Google of saying sage grouse and raptors. There's a lot of there's a nice bibliography here that shows some of that work that's already taken place. I'm not surprised that's something that people have brought up. We continue to see the number of different factors that have an impact on this bird and on the population. And I think that habitat clearly is one aspect. Fire obviously is having another one, but also it's been clearly that folks in Wyoming and Utah and Nevada and a number of other places have already done some research on the impact of raptors. In fact, they were killing ravens in Idaho as a result of this as well. So we do have quite a bit that's been done. The question really becomes, what is our next step, and how do we manage to have a really robust population in the state of Oregon so that we're not dealing with the kind of listing that's a possibility? That's what I'm interested in. So as you search around, those are the kind of questions that I'm having, and if you can come back to me on some of those things, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Klim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, you know, the reference to the spotted owl, I was 18 years old when the spotted owl was listed in my hometown, and you know, shortly thereafter, and then even before, because it was coming, my mom lost her job, my friend's parents lost their jobs. I mean, every mill is now closed. So that's the fear, obviously, that people who witnessed that saw. You know, we saw federal forest land volume, I think, go from 4.5 billion board feet to 120 million, and yet owls really didn't recover at the rate I think we thought. So people are afraid that, turns out it was the barred owl that needs to be shotgunned next, and you know, 20 years later. And that's, I think, the fear is, if what if we're wrong? What if it really is a combination of, no doubt there was a lot of overcutting going on. Lots of trees with nests got cut down before the Endangered Species Act. That happened for sure, no question. But the massive reduction in volume over time didn't seem to bring them back either, because nature has a way of making up for these situations, and other owls, you know, killed a lot of them. Meanwhile, nobody's working anymore. And so I get the fear. The question probably is, do we have the guts to pony up a bunch of cash to the agency so you can quit hunting them, so we can find out exactly what's going on and not have to use $100 to do it, or just wait and see what happens and lose all the income tax revenue from the entire, what's left of the rest of the state out there and their ability to pay taxes? Because I'm pretty sure if we could go back and invest in some science up front to avoid a spotted owl listing, it would have more than paid for itself now. And I think that's something we have to ask ourselves. Can we find some money so you don't have to go take, you know, I buy an upland game stamp. I don't shoot sage grouse, but I do shoot other grouse. You're not supposed to use my, you know, blue grouse money for sage grouse, so can we find some cash so you can go do this? Because I think our position that it shouldn't be listed is good. I don't know if the feds care what we think, to be honest, in the end, or if the law cares what we think in the end. And so numbers will prove it, and you need money, it sounds like, to probably prove it. Habitat is always what we like to go to, in part because it's true and in part because it's what we believe we can control, and we can't control nature. But we can at least prove to somebody else, hopefully, that nature takes its course as well. And so you can't blame man is on the earth whether you like it or not. So at this point, we're going to have to deal with the fact that we are here and what we can control, you know, are other populations, because a lot of us got guns, and I'd go hunt ravens with you, you know, Representative Krieger, if that's what you really want to do this summer.
I think it'd be fun.
So you can't insult the raven, though, and call him dumb as a bag of hammers before we shoot him.
No, but you don't even need a gun to get this.
Thank you, committee members. I went on a tour of Eastern Oregon with Vice Chair Frederick back in December, and I was struck by the acreage that has just been overrun by invasive species. Medusa head and cheatgrass and you name it, on and on and on and on and on. And I am by no means an expert in either these invasive grasses or fire, but it seemed that we had a cycle going on here where we burn the Medusa head, and if it was a forest, it would be stand replacement fires, but we're burning the landscape. We've had the biggest fire here a couple years ago in 150 years in our state. I think these invasive grasses are a large part of the problem. I don't know how our state would ever even contemplate raising the necessary revenue to be able to deal with a problem on that scale. So we are going to have to be exceedingly reliant upon the goodwill and the good works of our agricultural community and many others throughout the sage grouse's core habitat. When Representative Frederick and I were over there, we found a lot, virtually universal, willing partners. And I think it is time that we sat down with our partners and started figuring out how we're all going to deal with this. We cannot be shutting down 40% of our state. Folks, this is a prescription for disaster. The folks are willing to help. I'm convinced of it. They convinced us. Let's get a plan together, and let's get them to work. Additionally, following up on Representative Clem's comments, when it gets down to studying predation and assuming that we're going to find problems with predation populations, I hope that the first place that we do not go to is raising fees on the hunting community. We've got a lot of folks out there that also are willing to help out. And the hunting community, again, in every meeting that we've had, are willing to do their share. They're willing to be partners. They're willing to help find a solution. Let's use the folks that are willing to help for free, for free. With that, folks, I am going to have to excuse this panel. Folks, thank you very, very much. Don, that was a tremendous first up at bat. In one sense, I hope we don't have to see you here too much anymore, but you did a tremendous job. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you.
That's pretty clear comment.
I'm sorry.
Hey, perhaps if you would buy a sage grouse tag.
beans are dumb as a sack of hammers. He'd be more successful than he was when he hunted turkeys.
Oh, I knew that. Don't.
You know something, Krieger? You could even get one of these things.
I knew it, yeah.
Mercy. All right. With that, I'm going to call up next, please, Judge Perry and John O'Keefe and Commissioner Nichols. Welcome to our committee, gentlemen. Thanks for making yourselves available. Please decide among yourselves the order that you'll proceed, and if you will, each of you introduce yourselves as you begin your testimony.
How do we want to do this?
Introduction, my name is Dan Nichols. I have been privileged and honored to be in my fifth term of service as Harney County Commissioner to the people in Harney County. Also been a rancher in the Steens Mountain area, Diamond Valley. It's a place to come from. Every time you testify, you come in with written testimony, and then through the course of the proceedings, everything changes. And I want to thank you as a committee for the questions. The points you brought forth, I was wishing I would have brought my pom-poms to cheer you on, and I'm not really a pom-pom type of guy. They were very insightful questions. It's questions we have, as counties, have been asking for 4 years minimum. The things you addressed today are the things that need to be addressed, and we need to focus on. And I better get back to my testimony. They did have a few things that I absolutely wanted to say in regard. So,
please.
Harney County is a natural resource-based community, like most of Oregon. It is unique in that regard. We had a wood products industry that is all gone and devastated, and the potential listing of the greater sage-grouse could and probably will create a debilitating effect on our ranching and farming business that remains in our county. Facing the possible listing of the greater sage-grouse, the Harney County Soil and Water Conservation District initiated a collaborative effort with a large, diverse group of stakeholders to develop a programmatic candidate conservation agreement assurances. Group members included U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Oregon State Lands, Green State University Extension, Eastern Marine Research Station, County Court, Nature Conservancy, and business leaders. After nearly 3 years of meetings, edits, rewrites, and review, the SWCD and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service entered into a CCA last Wednesday that will be an enabling factor for the continuance of the ongoing efforts of Oregonians toward the conservation of the greater sage-grouse in Harney County. In addition, Oregon, with the leadership from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, has entered into a candidate conservation agreement with the BLM. Oregon, as it has been historically, is covering the bases. We are doing it and have been doing it for decades. In regard to the CCAA, as a voluntary participant in that contract, landowners agree to manage their property to continue to remove or reduce threats to the species. In return, landowners receive assurances from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service against additional regulatory requirements should the grouse be listed in the future. The Harney County CCAA encompasses over 1 million acres of private land and 29 private landowners encompassing over or committed to enrolling over 250,000 acres even prior to the finalization and signing of the CCAA last week. This is the type of voluntary commitment Oregonians repeatedly display to show our resolve and understanding of the importance of good stewardship for the protection of our natural resources. Seven other eastern Oregon counties are currently in the process of developing CCAAs. It's a huge step forward. It shows that Oregon cares as a whole. Again, we are covering the bases, but with this success comes accountability. These contracts are potentially 30-year contracts. You have to go through the enrollment process. You have to maintain a monitoring process annually. There is a huge cost to the administration of these contracts. Currently in Harney County, they've been applying for grants. When the other seven counties come on board, a lot of these grant funding sources are going to be hit hard. There's going to be a need for funding of the monitoring and the continuation, perpetuation of these CCA agreements within the state. That's the bad news. That's just one of the costs incurred. Due to the foresight of past state leadership, the resulting development of Oregon's land use planning, and decades of adherence to the policy statewide, Oregon does not have the habitat fragmentation issues that are of concern in other western states. Oregon's focus needs to be directed towards those factors that have been mentioned here already. That is wildfire, juniper encroachment, invasive grasses and weeds, and thankfully, Representative, the question of predation. We brought it up continually for the past 4 years. It has been courteously sidestepped and ignored. Predation is an absolute major, major problem with the species. The people from our communities that live and work on the land, they see it. It needs to be addressed. The sooner we address it, the more helpful and beneficial it will be to the habitat. Again, as stated, we're locking up potentially 40% of the landmass in Oregon. We have created hundreds of thousands of acres of pseudo-wilderness by default because of the core areas. Oregon cannot afford to have any more kinds of those hindrances put on the utilization of our land and our resources. Representative Esquivel, you asked what we can do. One of the best things, or one of the extremely good things Oregon has been doing, is the Oregon Department of Forestry has been supporting communities in the development of the Rangeland Fire Protection Associations. In Harney County alone, we developed two of them in the last 2 years. I believe there are five of them. There's better than 150 volunteers in Harney County for the Rural Fire Protection Associations. This effort has made a tremendous impact at the local level in the ability to strategically intervene in wildfire situation. The two fires that occurred 2 years ago in Malheur and Harney counties, two fires, 1.3 million acres burnt of sage-grouse habitat. And with the Rural Fire Protection Associations as a component of that, they can be an extreme help in mitigating, stopping, having a positive effect on the control of those fires before they get to that catastrophic level. We in Harney County have initiated another Oregon Consensus Project to look at some of those kinds of things. And I don't mean, Harney County has initiated, I believe, six different consensus projects to be ahead of where we should be in the protection and care of our natural resources. That is another thing that comes from state support, state funding, the governor's endorsement. It's always appreciated when we get state backing to help when we are attempting to get things done at the local level. In summary, Oregon has set the bar for other states to emulate in regard for controlling habitat fragmentation. As a result of the past legislative endeavors, Oregon counties have the means, the initiative, and local support to voluntarily address issues concerning sage-grouse habitat for the benefit of the species. State efforts need to remain focused on the identified threats to sage-grouse habitat in Oregon: wildfire, juniper encroachment, invasive weeds and grasses, and a further, more complete, upfront discussion of predator control. State support for the RFPA program through the Department of Forestry needs to continue and bolstered if possible. I would like to express my appreciation for the SageCon effort initiated by the state, or at the state level. The collaborative effort that is being put into the process is indicative of how Oregon views and addresses issues of environmental concern. The degree of county perspectives, the inclusion of the perspective, shows that the state government is an understanding and supportive partner across jurisdictional realms. It's very much appreciated to have a conversation with state at all levels. Collectively, we are making a difference. The state needs to stand strong in the affirmation and support of the statewide efforts that have been occurring for decades for the management of our natural resources and continue to challenge the questionable attributes of continually overlaying regulatory mechanisms for the protection of our resources. Regulation does not equate to protection. So I thank you very much as a committee for the opportunity to address you this afternoon.
Commissioner, thank you very, very much. And I'm sure that you, as well as our other two panelists, would agree that all the good folks over in Eastern Oregon are willing to do their share. We just need to give them the opportunity.
Very well said.
Thank you for your appearance and your testimony. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Witt, the committee. For the record, my name is John O'Keefe. I'm the Oregon Cattlemen's Association's representative to the SageCon effort. A listing under the ESA would not be an answer for sage grouse. A listing would create a burdensome layer of bureaucracy on any federal permit in sage grouse habitat. Specifically for ranchers, it could create undue pressure on private lands while grazing on the federal permits were in flux. Litigation on technicalities and process would occur. Family farms would have to spend their hard-earned dollars to protect their interests, while well-funded environmental groups would litigate for free with EJIA dollars. That's equal access to justice. Conservation measures would become difficult or impossible. Agencies would have difficulty approving needed range improvements with the additional workload. Examples could be a fence needed to implement a grazing system change or water development that could change grazing utilization patterns. In 2010, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service ruled sage grouse as warranted but precluded. This created the perfect situation for sage grouse. All across the West, involved parties engaged in conservation efforts to head off a listing. Yet environmental groups sued, and in a behind-closed-door settlement, this period of intense sage grouse conservation was scheduled to end in 2015. It is rarely productive to speculate on the motives of others, but it is tempting to think that the thought process must have been, we need to get this listed before we lose the opportunity. What are the threats to sage grouse? As we've already heard here today, conifer encroachment, annual grasses, and wildfire, as is published in the Federal Register by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Obviously, we've heard today that predator is also a major issue on our minds. What's an answer for sage grouse? Active conservation. The NRCS Sage Grouse Initiative since 2010 has strategically removed 275,000 acres of conifer, mostly juniper. It's protected 380,000 acres through easements, and 2.6 million acres have had enhanced grazing systems implemented. Proper grazing systems have amazing results on the ground. I'm proud of my range, but I've been to the Deseret, and I've seen some things that I'd like to try as well. There's some real future in the sagebrush with manipulating our grazing. The final tab, 3,500,000 in on-the-ground conservation. On a little more local level, the Harney County CCA, which Dan explained in detail, I'll just gloss over that, but I do want to say that it wasn't an accident that this happened in Burns, Oregon. The Eastern Oregon Ag Research Center and the ARS station there, the scientists there produce some of the premier range science in the world. You know, we've talked for a while today about the three problems, the juniper and wildfire and the invasive annuals. Well, we know how to cut down juniper and we know how to put out fire. It's not easy, but it's tough to do. But the invasive annuals is still a little bit of a riddle. But when that riddle is solved, the technology and science that does it will come from Burns, Oregon. So that is a stellar place. The CCAA was an inspiring effort to watch as the community, ranchers, and scientists pulled together with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to create this conservation agreement. And as Dan also pointed out, the Oregon Cattlemen did work with the BLM for a corollary agreement that works on the federal grazing permits. Why are ranchers important to sage-grouse? Fire and fuel control. The rural fire associations bring a lot to the table. Their members live closer to the fires. They're there 24/7. They know the roads. They know the terrain. This is a huge advantage in the dark. Dark is often key in keeping fire small on initial attack. Fuel control. We saw what happened in 2012 when we had a high production year followed by dry conditions. If we don't have livestock out there to address the fine fuels accumulation, every year has the potential to be 2012. Open space. The West was open for homesteading for many, many years, and ownership patterns reflect this. The land that was important for agriculture is also important for wildlife. If ranchers cannot operate on the scale they operate now, there will be development on these lands, subdivision, vacation homes, other types of things. Water development, both on public and private land. The ranchers maintain this water largely. If the ranchers go away, this water will largely go away. Brood-rearing habitat. In much of the arid West, irrigated meadows provide brood-rearing habitat. These will dry up if the ranchers are gone. Weed control. Ranchers are the only ones that cover the landscape enough to find weed infestations when they're small and eradicate them. I've done this at least four times. If you find a new patch of weeds the size of your hat, you can deal with it. If your range con has to find it, it'll probably be over 100 acres when he gets away from the office and happens to see it. They're good folks, but they're overworked and they're stuck in the office. Well-managed ranches control their weeds. Over the years, the weed wrecks I've seen have happened to properties that have been in receivership. If ranching ceases to be viable, this will become a risk. This is a partial list of the benefit of working ranches to sage-grouse. To quote Tom Sharp, the chairman of the Harney County CCAA effort, what's good for the herd is good for the bird. Currently, there is a bill in front of both the U.S. House and Senate that would forestall a listing for 10 years in states that have a sage-grouse management plan in place. This would go a long way to restoring positive incentives to do on-the-ground sage-grouse conservation that gets lost in the bureaucratic burden and litigation battles that come with the ESA listing. It also makes it very clear that it's important for the state to get this plan right. As the state planning effort goes forward, one of the issues that will need to be resolved is how much disturbance can be allowed in sage-grouse habitat. This is clearly an issue where the devil is in the details. Much of the science about this has come from studies around energy development. A road serving an oil field may get 30 vehicles an hour. A typical road in Oregon's Great Basin with the same disturbance footprint might get 2 vehicles a day. Sage-grouse will avoid the area around a well pad, but they use areas of a hayfield near the edge for brood-rearing habitat. It will be important to take these differences into account and get it right to conserve sage-grouse while allowing agriculture to be viable and responsive to changing conditions. Funding. Funding will be a big issue as the state plan goes forward. As funding is discussed, it is important to remember it will take ongoing research to get it right. Invasive annuals is a case in point. There was some discussion during this year's short session as to how the livestock industry and other members of the public might support funding for the state plan. Agreement was not reached, but the Oregon Cattlemen's Association is committed to continuing this conversation. This is important for both on-the-ground conservation implementation, as well as showing the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that the Oregon plan is dedicated funding. The policy for evaluating conservation efforts allows the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to give greater weight to plans with dedicated funding when considering a listing decision. Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you very, very much, John.
Judge, welcome.
For the record, I'm Beaver County Judge Chris Perry, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of small communities in all of rural eastern Oregon. Although my county is not a sage-grouse county, I serve on the Snake River John Day River RAC, which is a resource advisory council that advises over a large area of eastern Oregon, portions of Washington, and parts of Idaho. So sage-grouse is a very big topic in this committee. We advise on commercial use of public lands, and with the sage-grouse listing would come no commercial use of public lands, so there would probably not be much cause for having a resource advisory committee. So I wanted to hit upon the effects that sage-grouse listing would have on small rural communities. Like Harney County, Wheeler County has lost its milling industry. It lost it a little bit earlier, but that effect it had by losing the milling industry took the county population in half. We lost half of our population in our county in a short period of time. With the listing of sage-grouse, we have a viable ranching community, and the viability of that community is the use of public lands for grazing. For a lot of them ranches to be viable, they have to have a permit to go along with it for grazing. Otherwise, it turns into a non-viable enterprise. So I would like to use a parable that I use for my studies. I have 1,700 square miles of county. I have three communities. In each community is a preschool. I go to my preschools and I ask each preschooler what his daddy does for a living. And if his daddy says that he's working in a mill, or he's cutting juniper, he's in this new juniper industry, or his daddy's a rancher, or his dad works on a ranch. It's one of the best tools I have locally to see how viable and how strong my communities are doing. It sounds kind of a simple way of doing it, but when you have basically 20 preschoolers over 1,700 square miles, it's an effective tool. And I see the listing coming down the road, and with the listing of that, I bet I'll have 10 kids in my preschools and none of their daddies working on ranches. So I'd like to support the 10-year plan, and I think that the people on the land are the ones that are going to make this sage-grouse issue work. I'd like to hit upon the rural firefighting community. The response time in my particular county for BLM or Forest Service to, I have two national forests in my county, the Ochoco and the Umatilla, for them to, and 300,000 acres of unprotected lands. The response time for BLM or Forest Service to respond from outside of the county into my county may be hours, unless they are able to use aircraft to to use to fight these fires. And we all know what the cost to the state and to the federal government is on retardant drops. There is a huge savings to the state and to the federal government in the use of these small firefighting agencies scattered throughout rural Oregon, and I appreciate the support the state gives with equipment lending, equipment programs for these small rural fire departments, and I would like to see their continued support.
Great.
With that, I will turn this over to comments. If you have any questions of the panel, I'd
Thank you very, very much. Thank you very much. Committee members, I have gotten us severely behind schedule, but I thought it was important that these folks got an opportunity to express their concerns on the record and get the full story out. So now I've got us in a position where I'm going to have to limit our questions. Is there any committee member with a burning question that we absolutely have to get out at this point? Yes, Senator Wilson.
I just wanted to make a one-minute comment relative to Mr. O'Keefe's testimony. The amount of acres that have been treated, protected, or enhanced to improve sage-grouse habitat totals 3.255 million acres. That is over 5,000 square miles. If you wanted to put that into perspective, if you go from the Columbia River somewhere south of Eugene, 50 miles wide,
yes,
that is what has already been restored for the sage-grouse. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Gentlemen, your statements were excellent. They were very comprehensive in nature. I recognize that you have driven a very long ways to get here, have a very long ways to go back. You're doing everything that you can to help us avoid this listing, and we certainly appreciate your efforts and look forward to being able to work with you in the future here to prevent this listing if we can possibly do so. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call up, please, Kathy McDonald and Varner Seaman. And if it was at all possible for you to both summarize your statements, I would be greatly appreciative. Thank you. And welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Witt and members of the committee. My name is Catherine McDonald. I'm the Conservation Director for the Nature Conservancy. And really, I think a lot of really important points have been brought up today by previous panel members and the committee members about the big challenge facing a significant area of Oregon if we don't really buckle down and get this plan right. So I think that there have been some great comments. I wanted to just really focus in on four points. One, you know, the decline of sage-grouse is obviously very significant. The key issues has been described before are fire, invasive species, and conifer expansion. And in some ways, we see this species more like the canary in the mine than the sage-grouse, because we see that there are some opportunities if we can approach this in a good way to do things that not only benefit sage-grouse but also help ag producers, agricultural producers in southeast Oregon. So I think there's an opportunity here to really look at ways that we can approach recovery of sage-grouse that also provide benefits to rural communities, jobs, and agricultural production. Second, just very quickly, sage-grouse are very sensitive to disturbance and anthropogenic disturbances, roads, buildings, and the like. And I want to just echo what John O'Keefe said just a minute ago, that I think we are going to need some additional tweaks to our regulations to be able to meet the Fish and Wildlife Service's regulatory assurances test, and the devil is in the detail, and we are going to have to work really hard to get it right. I completely support what he said about that. Third, we think that that getting it right part relative to disturbance is really coming up with a metered approach and an adaptive management approach to that, so that if we can turn things around, then we can kind of loosen things up over time. Fourth, I just wanted to kind of appreciated Representative Clem's comments about the need for investment. And I do think because of the nature of the things that we're facing, we're not going to be able to do that with regulations, and not that we want to anyway, but we're not going to be able to do that. And making an investment in Southeast Oregon is really going to provide the needed grease to turn this around and make sure that we're not only benefiting sage grouse, but also the communities in rural Eastern Oregon and providing jobs. And we've been working really hard to try and do what we can to contribute to this effort. We've been developing landscape assessments and tools that will help make strategic investments. We're working really hard with the Agricultural Research Station that John O'Keefe mentioned, to develop better restoration techniques through kind of precision restoration concepts. And we're also looking and working hard to try and develop effective and efficient protocols for mitigation so that it can be done really efficiently and effectively. Thank you.
Welcome. Good afternoon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll keep this pretty brief. For the record, my name is Varner Seaman. I'm the policy director at Renewable Northwest. And the reason I'm talking here today is that wind, solar, geothermal development, we think, have a positive potential impact in some of the areas where sage grouse occur, to provide some investment into communities, to create some jobs, and to provide some tax revenue in addition to landowner payments. The sage grouse issue just is a little bit of a different perspective that I have on this issue from some of the other folks who've talked. This is something that I've been working on since about 2009, not just in Oregon, but west-wide. And in 2009, I was working for a renewable energy company, Horizon Wind Energy, which was a developer in Wyoming. And when Wyoming took really the lead in terms of a core areas approach towards sage grouse, they essentially said, we're going to create some core areas, and those areas are going to be no-go for development, period, any kind of development. And what we really saw was in 2009 and really to the present, the state of Wyoming became just a shut-off area where, especially for the wind industry, there was no investment that could take place. And I think Richard Whitman has gotten sick of hearing me say in virtually every meeting I've been in with him over the last year and a half that Oregon should not replicate what they did in Wyoming. I think he kind of, you know, nods along and gets kind of annoyed by that. And I think that looking west-wide at what other states have done versus what is happening in Oregon, one, I would note that there is much higher participation across a broad sector here in Oregon. There are a lot of people around the table. When you go to the SageCon meetings, there are it's kind of standing room only. I mean, I think at times we'll have 50, 60 people in the room, a bunch of other people on the phone. Just doing introductions can take a pretty long period of time to get through these. And there is a much more collaborative approach that we're looking at here. And I think one of the things that we're very optimistic about, cautiously optimistic about, because there's a lot of work to do between now and when the plan is submitted to the federal government, is the core areas approach that we're looking at here in Oregon would actually allow some level of development to occur in those core areas. And from a renewable energy perspective, we could actually see some modest potential, assuming we can get some mitigation things done right, development that could continue to occur in these parts of the state, which would be based on the best available science in terms of what disturbances could be, but we could actually see where we could have a sage grouse plan for the state of Oregon that wouldn't necessarily be just a hard stop, can't build anything anymore. So I had a longer, more nuanced approach to this, but I just, in the interest of time, wanted to be kind of short with it and say I think we've actually got a little bit better approach that we're working on here in Oregon than what we were seeing in some other states. And I think one of the things that's important is the plan we have to avoid a listing should not be worse than a listing. And I think that should be the standard that we have. And I think that hopefully we're, and I think that, you know, there's a lot of work to be done over the course of the rest of the year. And I think a lot of the questions here kind of got to that. And I think that the anxieties in the communities in the state are founded. And, you know, as we talked about the spotted owl experience, I think it's, people are justified in having their concern. I think that we've got some good work going on, and I'm cautiously optimistic about it, at least from our perspective. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for your contributions towards that that good work and towards a positive end and positive outcome here. Again, committee members, seriously behind schedule. Do we have a burning question? I'm seeing none. Thank you both very, very much for your testimony and your contributions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Pause for 1 minute here.
Okay.
So this group needs to go to the next committee. Mm-hmm. Just to have it. He's willing to wait until September. If you want to, okay. They are willing to wait as well. So another idea is you could go to this next, do this, and they'll be ready to come in and kick the picture.
Okay. Okay. Why don't we do that?
Okay, so we go next to this.
The most incredible thing I've ever seen.
But this group needs to go next.
Okay. We are going to have to share witnesses with the hearing going on next door, so we're going to change up our agenda a little bit and go to the biomass overview. And I'd like to invite up, please, Andy Ginsberg and Matt Krumenauer.
The Natural Desert Association or whatever.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon. Chair Witt, Vice Chair Frederick, members of the committee. My name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the administrator of the Planning, Policy, and Technical Analysis Division at the Oregon Department of Energy. Some of you might remember me from my former role at DEQ, but I'm now with Energy. With me is Matt Krumenauer, who is a senior policy analyst in my division. And at the request of the committee, Matt's going to provide a primer on biomass energy in Oregon. Now, we don't have any proposals regarding biomass energy for you today, but we're hopeful that this background information that Matt will be providing will be helpful to you in the future as you consider any potential proposals to advance biomass energy in our state at that time. So with that, I'll turn it over to Matt.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair Witt, Vice Chair Frederick, members of the committee. I'm honored to be here today. I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. I know you're behind, so if I am going too fast, please stop and ask questions or give me a signal. Bioenergy is unique in all of the different renewable energies that Oregon can provide in that it requires a specifically sourced fuel. You don't need to contract with the sun in order to power a solar panel. Likewise, we don't need to buy wind from the atmosphere. But we do need to source feedstock for bioenergy facilities, and that opens up a series of different challenges, but also a series of opportunities that can provide a lot of benefit to our state and the industries that use these. So I'd like to start off with a slide, if I can get it. There we go. With this sort of whimsical little diagram, because it helps me ground myself in what we're talking about. When we talk about biomass and bioenergy, we're not talking about any one thing. If you look at the top, we're talking about a variety of different types of feedstocks, either from our fields, from our forest, the byproducts of industrial processing of some sort, primarily in our food products and forest products industries. And then across the middle, you see we have a number of different types of conversion technologies, which are more or less appropriate for different types of feedstocks. And those yield different types of energy that we can use in different ways. And I like to start here because it reminds me that biomass is not one thing, bioenergy is not one thing. It's a number of different types of feedstocks that we can use in different ways to meet our energy needs in different ways. And I'm going to go through these in just a little bit. I'm going to talk a little bit about what the industry looks like in Oregon today, what some of the different feedstocks and different facilities that we have in the state are. What bioenergy brings to Oregon and brings to some of these key industries. And then I'll end with a very brief overview of the programs we have in place, some of the policies that have been established, and I'll even give you a rundown on what the state's investment to date in this industry has been. So here's a map we created of the different types of bioenergy facilities that we have in the state. We've got about 7 different biofuel production facilities, many of them biodiesel, a couple ethanol facilities. But about 10 wood pellet manufacturing facilities located around the state. We have a number of different landfills that are capturing the methane generated at those landfills, turning it into energy. We've got about 20 different biomass thermal projects providing space heat to schools and other buildings. About 17 different woody biomass power facilities that I'll go into in a little bit, and about 21 different anaerobic digesters. And I'm going to go into each of these in just a little bit of detail. In the presentation, I've got some of these notes that are takeaways. I'm not going to go through those. So here's the woody biomass production facilities. I mentioned there's about 17 of these. At least six of these are currently idle, and many of the remaining are not operating at full capacity for a variety of different reasons. Every one of these but one is co-located with a mill, providing thermal energy to the mill, as well as power that's either used on site or exported back onto the grid. The feedstocks they use, primarily mill residuals. It's traditionally been the lowest cost, highest quality fuel source generated right on site, not a lot of transportation cost to bring that into the system. But we're also seeing on the left-hand side slash from different forest management activities or harvest that is brought into these facilities to use as fuel instead of being burned out in the woods or otherwise disposed of or left to decompose. And then increasingly, we're looking at using biomass from forest restoration activities, thinning activities, other types of forest health restoration activities that can be taken off of those lands and used in a beneficial way because they don't have any other value. If there's no other market for these materials, they will be burned out there or they will be left to decompose, increasing the management costs associated with those activities. So using these in a beneficial way to produce energy can be a real benefit, not only in the form of renewable energy, but in the form of helping to support some of these other activities that we have. A few examples of the facilities that we have here in the state. On the top there is Evergreen Biopower. It's about a 10-megawatt facility located at the Ferris Lumber Mill over in Lyons, not far from Salem here. They use all of those different feedstocks I just pointed out, generate electricity, export that to the grid, and then they use the heat to power their dry kilns to dry some of their products that they make. Over on the right is a recently or soon to be reopened mill down in Cave Junction, Rough and Ready. A bit smaller, it's 1.2 megawatts, but very similar, using the heat, dry lumber in their kilns, as well as generate electricity. And then to the bottom left, there is an example of one of the mills that's idle. This is out in Prairie City. And I included this picture because there's a lot of forest restoration activities that are occurring in this part of the state. This facility could take some of that material, but is not operating. And so the alternative is trucking that material to the west side because there's not a lot of other facilities in that part of the state that can use those, use that material. On the smaller scale, we have biomass thermal facilities. These show the different schools, hospitals, or other buildings that use biomass, primarily pellets, to provide space heat. There's also about another 30 or so facilities that I don't have on the map that are industrial facilities that may have a boiler that can use biomass to provide just thermal energy for dry kilns, for other industrial process. But I didn't include those on the map just because we didn't have time, quite frankly. Here's a couple examples of those. On the left is an example of one of the facilities that has been built in at a school. Most of the school facilities have been installed in 2011, 2012, so very recent. In 2009, I think we had three in the state. Now we've got 20. So we've had some pretty good progress in moving these along. The big silo the children are standing in front of holds the fuel, so that's full of pellets that are used to heat the school. On the top right is a picture of the actual biomass system plus the fuel holding silo at the Blue Mountain Hospital in John Day. I use this example because this hospital is saving between $100,000 and $150,000 a year because they converted over to wood pellets. That money used to be sent out of the state primarily to buy fuel that was imported. Now they're sending that money down the street to the Malheur Lumber Company, which manufactures the pellets, partly from the remnants of forest restoration activities that are happening in that national forest. Not only is that a good story, that we're reinvesting our energy dollars in our local communities, but this is a critical access hospital, meaning that it's one of the few in that community that can provide services. And this system has helped make their energy use more resilient to interruptions in fossil fuel distribution or other activities that could happen. Their fuel is right there on site, and that silo provides a number of days' worth of storage in the event that other sources were disrupted. And many of these boilers that have been installed in systems are actually manufactured right here in Oregon, or assembled right here in Oregon. There's a plant in St. Helens that's made a lot of these facilities, so you get a lot of benefits to the state from this. And then the bottom right is another interesting one. This is Steve Hesacker standing in front of a little biomass gas fire he installed at his farm in Forest Grove. I sat with him at his kitchen table, and he told me about this pile of blanks and shells and twigs that he has to pay a lot of money each year to dispose of while he's buying fuel to use to dry his hazelnuts. And he said, I want to switch that around. And he did. And so that system right behind him is a little biomass gasifier he feeds that material into, and it provides the thermal energy to dry his product. Like I said, most of these facilities use pellets that are manufactured right here in Oregon at one of those 10 pellet manufacturing facilities that are in the state. But also we're seeing facilities that are using wood chips or other materials directly from the forest, either from forest health treatments or from other sources. And so a lot of homegrown fuel being used in these facilities. Moving into the anaerobic digestion side, this is a different technology. The woody biomass technologies have been primarily combustion-based. This is actually a biological process. So bugs are converting organic material into biogas, which has got a large proportion of methane in it. So it functions very much like natural gas does. Of the 21 facilities, about 11 of those are at wastewater treatment plants. Many of those have been leaders in this industry, but increasingly we've seen others developed on farms, food processing facilities, and elsewhere. They use a variety of different types of feedstocks from some of the different agricultural residuals we have. We have at least one facility that's taking grass straw out of the valley, digesting that, turning that into renewable energy. Also, pre- and post-consumer food waste, either materials that are being collected at the curbside in some of the cities that have implemented those programs, or expired materials from distribution companies, grocery stores, food processors, dairy products. Instead of converting those materials into, you know, landfills and entombing the nutrients and the energy potential that's in those materials, we can put those into an anaerobic digester, get renewable energy, recycle those nutrients, and provide a lot of other co-benefits. This is another example I like to use. Most of the sewage overflows that happen in our cities are caused by grease clogging the pipes, grease from restaurants. That is also a really high energy potential feedstock. So many of the wastewater treatment industries are taking some of that waste grease and collecting it directly instead of encouraging it to be flushed through the system. They're injecting that into their digesters, increasing their biogas production, and reducing the cost to those municipalities of managing and cleaning the pipes with that material. So again, you're getting another co-benefit out of taking that material and using it as a feedstock for a bioenergy source here. And of course, manure, no presentation on bioenergy would be complete without a little discussion of that. We have seen a number of different anaerobic digesters built at a dairy farm. On the right-hand side is an example down in Junction City. Lockmead Dairy installed this small biomass facility. The tanks that you see are where the manure is actually digested by the microorganisms. The top is a flexible membrane that stores the biogas. And then the engine is in that little storage box that you see. It's about a 190 kilowatt cogeneration system. So it burns the biogas, generates electricity. On the top left is the City of Gresham wastewater treatment plant. What you see in the left corner of that picture is the digester tanks. They're quite large. And then a big solar array. Through a combination of increasing the amount of biogas they're producing, partly through that waste grease collection, that solar installation, this facility is becoming completely energy independent, which is important because many times these wastewater treatment facilities are the largest energy users in their community. Add a lot of cost to that municipality, and when they're able to operate these systems independently and produce all their own energy, it's a great benefit all around. And then the bottom picture is a new facility. It's a, what we'd call a merchant biogas facility, meaning it's accepting a variety of different feedstocks, grass straw, it's accepting food waste out of the Portland area, other types of waste from food processors and other facilities, turning it into renewable energy that's provided back to utility customers. And it's also capturing nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium out of those feedstocks and applying those to the farm fields that are across the street, grass farmers, but also a farmer that's growing food for the Oregon Food Bank. And so it's actually a really good story about how we're capturing not only the renewable energy benefits, but those renewable co-benefits. We don't have to import fossil-based fertilizers if we can recycle them through systems like this. So that brings me to transition into why this is important. And I think I hit some of these points, but really biomass and bioenergy projects can support key Oregon industries by providing an option for them to help manage some of their waste products, can help them turn their systems into renewable energy generation systems that they can use on site, extract some of those other co-benefits, and add additional revenue streams. I mentioned the Malheur Lumber Company. When they put in a pellet mill, that generates another source of revenue that helps diversify that business, strengthen that mill, and helps provide more resiliency to that business, not to mention our energy system. It also helps leverage our natural resource objectives. When we use biomass to produce energy instead of burning it out in the fields, we're putting people to work, we're reducing air quality impacts, and we're helping stretch those limited federal forest restoration dollars across additional acres. Similarly, when we're digesting animal manure or other types of waste that would be landfilled or land spread, we're helping improve water quality, we're helping manage that material better, and we're helping manage nutrients better on our farms for the health of our soils and for the benefit of those farmers. And then finally, we do get the renewable energy benefits, which you've all heard of before, and we're getting those renewable co-benefits, whether it be in the form of nutrient capture, whether it be in the form of air quality improvements, other things. These provide a lot of other benefits besides just renewable energy. Back in 2005, the state established this policy through Senate Bill 1072. This was really a result of some of the large forest fires that the state had seen, Biscuit Fire, B&B Complex Fire. State established a policy of supporting these types of facilities that produce energy from these feedstocks that are generated right here in Oregon. Biomass energy facilities are eligible for the Renewable Portfolio Standard. We have a Renewable Fuel Standard. Many of these systems are eligible for the same types of utility regulatory treatments that other renewable energy technologies are, but not all of them. And then we also have some limited exemptions for, like, biofuel manufacturers from an energy facility siting process. So there has been some progress made in trying to smooth the pathway for development. Challenges still exist to these types of facilities, but we've done some. Here's some of the programs that we have in place. Again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time, but we've got a biomass production or collection tax credit, which helps support some of the high cost of collecting this type of material. We've partnered with the Department of Forestry and some of our federal partners and nonprofit entities in the state to target wood energy cluster developments that are strategically located near forest health needs and existing infrastructure. We've got a loan program. We've got an incentive program that can provide some support. And, of course, the Energy Trust of Oregon is able to provide some support to this industry as well. If you look, since about 2000, the state's invested about $174.7 million in this industry. I have a little bit of a breakout on where that's gone to, about $15 million towards anaerobic digestion, almost $98 million for woody biomass projects of various sorts. This has supported both the equipment used to calculate or to collect and process that equipment, but also the facilities that convert that biomass into energy. Pellets, biofuels, but a pretty diverse and effective investment. And then I wanted to provide a little bit more detail on the Biomass Producer or Collector Tax Credit Program. This is a breakout by year from 2010 of the different types of feedstock that program supports and the dollars that have been provided to support that type of feedstock. And I think one of the points I wanted to make is highlighted in the graphs there. There's been a change in how this program has been utilized over time. The largest proportion in 2010 was woody biomass.
and that is transitioned into manure that's used to produce biogas, being the largest portion. Part of that is due to a change in the way the tax credit was collected in 2012. It went from being collected calculated on a wet ton basis to a dry ton basis. Manure is still collected on a wet ton basis. So just a change in the way that the program was structured has resulted in that. But we've also continued to see a decline in the amount of woody biomass that's used to produce energy because of a variety of different market factors facing that industry. With that, I want to end with sort of just a summary of what I've said is that, one, we've got some facilities of various types located around the state. There's a heck of a lot of opportunity out there for more, especially more of the benefits that these can provide in those other areas in addition to renewable energy. And we've had a lot of programs that have been put in place to do this, and there's some opportunity to take a look at those programs to see how we could continue to provide benefits to this industry. So sorry for the rapidness that I went through this, but I'm happy to take any questions or get any other information for you.
Well, thank you for your assistance in helping to get us through the agenda. This is an absolutely wonderful presentation, and would be interested in any of your recommendations where our committee might be helpful, but I would like to ask the committee if they have questions or comments first, and I'm going to recognize Representative Reardon.
Thank you. Just curious about two questions here, if I may. How does the cost of the power generated on these systems compared with other sources of power?
Great. Chair Witt, Representative Reardon. It's every system is going to be a little bit different. The actual cost of power generation from biomass systems can be greater than the market price for power that the utilities are buying, and can also be greater than like utility scale wind. Mm-hmm. But it can be cost competitive to other types of renewables. When you get into the smaller scale, there's challenges because of transmission losses, wheeling costs, and other things. But when you begin to round out some of the other benefits that are provided by these systems that are not really financially recognized in the price for power, you're getting a lot of benefit from biomass energy that's not being captured in the price that the value of the electricity that they're generating.
Yeah. You know, please. One of the concerns I hear occasionally is that, if we have a major tsunami or something on the coast, that they could be cut off from the grid, and so, you know, we need to develop more power generation on the left side of the mountains. And yet I saw only a couple of biomass blips on your map. Any ideas on how we could promote more generation on that side, or would that be helpful to have greater generation on that on the coast?
Thank you, Chair Witt. Representative Reardon. I don't think I'm prepared to offer any recommendations on that right now, but that's certainly one of the things that we'd love to be able to work with stakeholders and come back in September as part of some options or ideas for how this industry could be moved forward, because I agree, there is a need for additional resiliency. There are opportunities with this type of technology to address that, but I can't address the specifics right now.
Thank you. Didn't mean to put you on the spot. But
oh, no, it's... Thank you.
Representative Whitsitt.
I was wondering if we're going to take this up later, if you could provide us with the actual cost breakdown, this is following up on Representative Reardon's, per kilowatt hour by generation type for what you just presented. So when you come back to us, you can show us, including the subsidies in there, that would help us when we're deciding what we want to support,
yeah.
I guess.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah. One other thing, if I may, Chair.
Please.
Thank you. In addition to that, the other thing I think would be interesting for the discussion would be the job creation and the contribution back to the local economy, and if there's any way that you could, and this is probably difficult, so if you can't, don't spend tons of time, but if you can figure out a way to compare, you know, the money that we collect and spend in-state, as you were describing, like at the John Day Hospital, for example, where we're spending the money that we used to spend out-of-state to go buy oil, now we're spending in-state, we're creating jobs, and what that economic activity then produces would be good to know, too, because part of our challenge oftentimes is that we're asked to subsidize things, and we don't quite know how what the economic impact is and whether or not we're getting a good bang from our buck. And this is both an energy-producing idea and an economics opportunity and development opportunity. So in both those cases, it'd be great to have that information as well, I think, for our discussion.
It would. Thank you, Representative Unger. And following up on that, if you could give us some more insight into the industries that have developed in Oregon that are manufacturing some of the items, some of the equipment that makes this possible, I think it would help us get a better feel for the impact that this has on our total economy. Yes, Vice Chair Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have the
BioBetsy here
ability and the privilege in Jackson County in our landfill that we generate electricity to about 7,000 homes, I believe, on a daily basis through the methane. The way they capture the methane is just fascinating, the way that intricate part of the piping is. And we're running constantly two 24-cylinder cat diesel generators around the clock. And it's about 7,000 homes we're lighting every day. So it does work. And that methane, the only thing they do with it other than that is burn it off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Representative Unger.
Thank you, Chair. One additional question. How does this program fit into the money that's been spent through the Betsy? And as the Betsy ends, how will the work that you do on these alternative energy facilities change?
Yeah, Chair Witt, Representative Unger, great question. The numbers I show on the slide were primarily from the Betsy program, the investment that was made through that program. Certainly moving forward, the resources that we have through the new energy incentive programs are a lot less than the Betsy would have, so there's certainly an impact. And I'd be happy to work with staff at our office to get you the numbers on how that investment compares to the overall investment some other things, but it's significantly less than the resources that had been available.
One quick follow-up. One of the things that we hear a lot about from the newspapers about the Betsy was kind of these huge, kind of shocking price tags on some of these bigger projects. How do these projects that you're talking about here compare in size and scope and investment? Like, what does it cost us to create a woody biomass facility that actually generates power that goes off of an off-site?
Yeah, Chair Witt, Representative Unger, at the risk of taking too much time, I want to briefly answer it, but I can follow up with some examples. Many of these facilities are what we would classify as community scale, meaning they're smaller. They're scaled to the need for the energy that's on-site or to the available feedstock. So many of these facilities are small, some of them less than a megawatt, so many of them less than 20 megawatts. There's only a couple of the facilities I've shown today that are larger than that. So the investment is significantly less than some of these very large-scale wind projects or other types of projects. An example that I showed you earlier was that JC Biomethane project, which was actually quite an expensive anaerobic digestion project because of the variability of feedstocks, the scale of the facility. That was about a $16 million facility. So even though it's a fairly significant investment, it's rather small compared to some of the larger investments in renewable energy we've seen.
And what's the output, follow-up, what's the output of that facility, do you?
I believe, and I think I included a inventory, list of the facilities in your handout. I believe it's about a 1.5 megawatt facility with the capability to increase their generation if they increase the amount of feedstock they produce.
And is it still true that the smaller scale facilities are actually easier to permit?
Chair, with the threshold for the Energy Facility Siting Council, for example, is 35 megawatts.
Okay.
So the smaller facilities typically do have a less onerous permitting pathway and project development pathway all around.
Very good. Any further questions? I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. It was an excellent presentation. You helped keep us or get us back onto schedule. And I think we've just about developed another whole hearing on this. So, so thank you very much for September's agenda as well.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony.
Thanks.
With that, I'd like to please call forward.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, we're going to be covering Western Juniper, and we heard some of the problems or challenges that Juniper presents us. We have some folks from the utilization group here to tell us how we can use that stuff. Again, welcome back, please, Judge Perry. Also, call up Kendall Derby and King Williams. And gentlemen, recognize that you have a lot of important information to tell us, but if you could, would it be possible for you to keep your comments close to 5 minutes, or 3 minutes would be better, 5 minutes maximum? Is that possible, each? Thank you very, very much. I appreciate that. Please introduce yourselves for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Representative Witt.
Good afternoon.
My name is Kendall Derby. I'm from Fossil, Oregon. I have a Juniper sawmill there.
Welcome.
I've been to Fossil.
All right.
Cool place.
Yeah. I'll carry on.
All right.
We've gone through a process in Oregon back in the 70s. There were murmurs of Juniper as an issue. We've done some research on it. Extension Service, Oregon State Rangeland Resources, of which I'm a product. And we've come to the conclusion that Juniper is an ecological wreck. In some regards, the area and density of Juniper is an issue on soil, water, and forage. So we're in a transition period now where we're finding Juniper is actually economic opportunity. So I'm actually get to be part of something that has opportunity, which is, you know, I'm not here to complain, or it's pretty nice to look forward. Restoration has occurred with the support of the environmental community, the Juniper Utilization Group. It's been a collaborative effort. We don't have people chaining themselves to juniper trees. So we have all, that's a plus. So the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board has been a real strong leader, Rangeland Resources, Oregon State, Extension, and Sustainable Northwest have all been very positive. And so I have four people working now. I expect to have more. I expect there's opportunity here. And I'll just conclude. It's Oregon's own. This is Oregon. Northern California has Juniper, but it's not the same. What we have here in Oregon is the good stuff. And so we have, it's organic, it's sustainable, it's beautiful. My example is back here on the table. And it's rural and it's opportunity. So.
Thank you very, very much. I've seen a number of Juniper products in the past, and it truly is beautiful, and I would urge everyone to walk by the table and just see how pretty a product it is. Truly, you're a success story. Thank you for building a business here in Oregon and helping us with a problem as well. Thank you very much.
Chair Witt, representatives, I'm, again, Judge Perry from Wheeler County. I would like to touch upon the social economic effects of Juniper in our community. Kendall is one of my constituents, and I'm happy to say he's fit a position in my preschool program that I told you about, how I monitor the health of my community. So I'd like to touch upon the fact that this is a product that we have an abundance of, and it's uncontroversial. It's a byproduct of good stewardship of watershed restoration, and it equates in economic sense for one job that it creates in my county or some of my adjoining rural counties
200 or more jobs that you would have in the Portland area, the effects into the local economy. So I'll keep it short since King probably has a lot more.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Welcome. My name is King Williams, and I'm with King Inc. is our corporation, and we have a supply contract with the Western Juniper Utilization Group. And could I ask, is Nancy going to testify here then, so I don't need to pick up her portion as well? That's what I was concerned about. What the Western Juniper Utilization Group, with the help of the legislature and private financing, embarked upon a program of trying to help the marketing and the supply to try to develop a juniper industry, to try to help at the present, you know, there's just a small handful of businesses that work in the juniper industry, and they were having trouble on two fronts. One of them was getting enough of the supply, which is kind of ironic considering that we got 9 million acres of this juniper in the, but getting it from the producer to the person, to the Kendall Derbys or the Gerard Lebrecht of Joseph Juniper or the LWOs, was a problem. So that's where my son and I have a corporation, and we were under contract with Western Juniper Utilization Group to help and assist in three areas. One of them is to put together a mapping package that would help to identify where these junipers might be and to be able to identify their proximity to roads, their juxtaposition on topography, the size and density of the products, because only certain kinds of wood could be utilized by the sawmills. And the great benefit of juniper as a wood product is it's, and I like to call it, it's an almost a terminal industry. We would be happy if the industry was successful enough that we didn't have a juniper problem in the state of Oregon anymore. But that's probably not going to happen for a long time. And as you've heard from the sage grouse panel that went on, juniper encroachment, and you folks have been through there and seen it, you know what it looks like. And as it's cut down and you try to dispose of it in by burning the pile or by broadcast burning or whatever it is you're going to do, the intensity of the heat is decreased if we can remove the boles from the trees, remove the log from the center of it, and leave only the limbs. So part of what we're doing is trying to get either utilize those out in the woods or to bring them into someone like Kendall's operation where he can cut them into products. That's one of the areas that we were doing, was identifying that. The second one was trying to get like the NRCS and OWEB and SWCD, Soil and Water Conservation Districts, have projects, and if we can match up those projects with the millers, with the people that are going to be doing that could utilize that material. It's just a logistics issue. It's pretty minimal. And the one thing we found out as we were going through this was that the Oregon Forest Practice Act, which tries in a way to exempt juniper from certain parts of their actions, have some issues with juniper in riparian areas, for instance, and there needs to be a clarification of some of the regulations. And it's, as we come to the legislature, as we come to the state of Oregon, we may be back asking that we need to tweak the Oregon Forest Practices Act, not to do anything environmentally insensitive, but in a riparian zone, for instance. Right now, you can't cut any timber in a certain part of it. Well, Juniper is one we want to get out of the riparian zone, but it runs in the face of that. So those are small kinds of things that happen. And the third one, the third area that we were working in is to try to coordinate with the state, with the federal agencies, the Forest Service and the BLM, because they are also doing projects, doing vegetative management projects. And what we found out was if they don't analyze for the removal and utilization of juniper during their NEPA process, then it can't be utilized. And some of the better juniper that Kendall and the other millers can use is because of the size and how straight or long they are,
yeah,
are in those areas. So those are some of the kinds of things that I've been working on. And in these small communities, it's been a big impact. It has a large impact in fossil. One of the few industries that's going on right now is the juniper industry in Harney County, in Burns. Joseph Juniper is kind of the same way. It's one of the few forest products industries that's going there. So with that, it's complementary to the sage-grouse program. I mean, as you can see, all we're doing is we're not doing anything but utilize the juniper that's already being removed as part of an ecological restoration program. I'll quit at that.
Thank you very, very much.
Just one small
comment,
please. I'd like to touch upon there's kind of a need for funding for to get juniper as a structural product, and that would be a great asset to our juniper group if we could have the funding done for that project for ODOT applications such as guardrail blocking, guardrail posts, signposts. There'd be a huge economic benefit to our rural communities if we could open up that market. And in order to do that, we need to have a structural kink and speak more to that.
I'm sorry, I missed the first bullet that we had right here.
Gentlemen, for our public record, when you switch, if you just identify yourselves, and the most recent comments were by Judge Perry, and if you'd just let us know who
King
you are.
King Williams.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. We do need funding to do certification of those wood products, mm-hmm, like WWPA or the American Wood Products Association certification, because any time there's any state procurement of wood products, just for a signpost, for instance, it requires some kind of certification for both the structural integrity, which doesn't, mm-hmm, need much in the case of a signpost, but would need more in the case of a guardrail stock. So there's some kind of certification. Oregon State University is at their lab can do that, that certification, but it will require some funding to do it, to carry on that product. But it would open up a place for the size and the type of material that we could cut from the juniper. So that's one of our important aspects of that we're coming to you for.
Well, thank you very much. And if you would all be so kind as to, when you're finished your analysis of what needs to be changed in the state law, if you would please let our committee know. I think we would be very interested in helping to facilitate your industry's development. So please, when you finalize your list, and the sooner the better so that we can get that in the legislative hopper, let us know.
King Williams, and we will. We plan on we're meeting with the ODF within the next 2 weeks with their staff to go over those kinds of opportunities.
Very good. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's another benefit to junipers that they take a substantial amount of water in an area that's hurting for water in the first place. I mean, I forgot how many gallons per day they take, but I mean, it's a bunch.
Kendall Derby for 35 gallons a day for a mature juniper
for one of them.
For one tree.
Yeah.
Incredible. Representative Whitson?
I just want to make a comment. I think it's great that you're utilizing the juniper. I'm from Klamath County, and I hate seeing it cut and just left to rot out. You know, we have a lot of projects going, and it's often just left to rot for years, and it takes a long time for it to decompose, basically. So I think this would be wonderful if we could use this, like for ODOT, for the things you're talking about. That would be so great to not leave the resource
on the ground. Absolutely. Absolutely. Vice Chair Frederick, did you have a comment?
Oh, it's just, thank you very much. Thank you, Chair Witt. As we were over in, when we were over in Eastern Oregon, one of the things we heard was the impact of juniper on such a wide range. The water was a clear issue. It being utilized as a perch for raptors on the sage grouse was another.
There you go.
Was another issue.
Darn raptors.
No. We heard that as well at the Extension Service, as I recall.
Yes, we did.
But as a cover because of the water, taking the water out, it ended up being a supportive environment for some of the annual grasses that we didn't want to see there. So this is an interesting sort of thing. I'm curious about the wide range of possibilities for the use of juniper. And quite frankly, something I'd like to have you speak to, because I know other folks probably know it better, certainly you know it better than I do. What gets in the way of using the juniper? Is it because you do not have the consistency of straight trees or straight limbs? Is it that it's difficult because it tears up the saws? What is it that gets in the way of the real use of this material?
Thank you for the question, Kendall Derby again. Also, LWO Corporation is, I believe, in your district. So they,
is that right?
Yeah, they have a direct connection with...
Oh, yes, that's right. Of course,
yeah.
I know them.
Yep, yep.
I know them.
Significant
right.
Milling presence in Eastern Oregon and juniper marketing development. So
right.
We're all connected. Juniper will come along. It's a wood. It's nothing crazy. It is very difficult on equipment. It's low density per acre. Usually the ground it's on is tough ground. But as far as things that are in the way, it's not that much. It's been history. It just needs to develop the market. The Sustainable Northwest is active developing the market. We have the technology to work it now. I think we're just coming around to it, but I think we'll see some significant progress.
Could I, King Williams? Part of what that is an excellent question, because it's on both sides. It's on the supply side, keeping a consistent supply, because anytime you're going to try to develop a market for a product, if it's going to be a market that's utilized on a consistent basis, say for signposts or in Lowe's, to buy it or Home Depot or something, they're going to want it on a consistent supply for raised flower beds or whatever they're going to do. So we needed to have to be able to connect the supply of the product with the millers. The second one is we have to develop those markets, you know, where those are, and that's where Nancy Hamilton will be. She has the marketing contract with Western Juniper Utilization Group, going out and finding what products can be cut reasonably. And then where can those products be marketed? For instance, in wineries, for landscape applications, because the big thing that's a benefit of juniper is it doesn't rot very fast. You know, so its resistance to rot is the benefit for the product, and so it's used instead of a treated material. And if you're trying to go organic, both in like a vineyard or in gardens or things, usually the use of juniper becomes the surrogate for it, becomes the option. And it's a little bit like branded beef. What we're trying to do is we're trying to sell that part of it, to say, hey, this is a good wood. We're marketing it. We're in the process, and that's what Nancy's. I'm talking for her, but that's her end.
Yeah, and Mr. Williams, she's not going to be able to make it over. Apparently, she's stuck in the other committee. So, if you had more that you wanted to discuss on her behalf, feel free. Representative Reardon, please.
Well, I'm so glad you came, because I really want to be a customer of yours. And I'll be building 6 raised beds next spring. So what I want to know is, where can I get it? And is it better than cedar? And how much is it compared to, say, other alternatives? Because you've got a market. It was my landscape person that told me about it, and I was shocked, because I just didn't think it would be available. So tell me a good story. Can I?
We parallel cedar price-wise, but we are doing landscape restoration and not logging in a rainforest in Canada. You know that most of our cedar comes out of Canada and the coastal woodlands. And so that there's a distinct benefit to that.
Okay.
Parallel price-wise.
Yeah.
Juniper is decay resistant, has a good history, good studies of that. And Sustainable Northwest in Southeast Portland is the largest, strongest.
You just happen to know where we all live or something? That's where I look. Sustainable Northwest.
Very smart. He did his homework.
Yeah, so that's Sustainable Northwest Wood on Division Place is the largest probably customer and marketer volume.
On Johnson Creek Road.
No, they're down on Division Place. Right.
Okay.
So.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. On your machine, are you doing a band mill, and are you doing 2 small band mills? Is that what it is? Well, two bands?
It is a band mill, yes, sir.
Single cut or a single cut?
Single cut band mill wood miser.
Okay.
And that technology basically came along in the 80s. So Grandpa's Juniper sawmill wasn't what's going now. My mill is a band mill. My kerf is 3/32 of an inch.
Okay. Wow. What's your length?
8.5 feet.
Okay.
That's fun, too, because the loggers all want to be 33-foot logs,
mm-hmm.
and they consider Juniper a runt. And but Juniper at 8.5 feet does just fine.
Sawmill. So. Very good.
One quick follow-up.
Excuse me, Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you, Chair Whitt. You did not mention the potential for pelleting. We just had a biofuel situation. Is that a possibility, and at what level is that a possibility?
Using it for biomass generation of energy is a possibility, or using it for pellets is a possibility. It can only be used, my understanding, for pellets. The Malheur Lumber Company that has a pelletizing mill there in John Day that has a pellet facility can use it, but only as a mix. And I don't know the exact mix they have. And I know that Prairie Wood Products, Cogen plant in Prairie City, made a run. They can burn it for Cogen power, except that the power rate, the abated tariff, is so low they can't run at all right now. But before they did that, they did run Juniper. My son, who's in the other committee and is the other half of King Inc., he has some property that he cleared the Juniper off of. Prairie Wood came in and ground it all and took it to their cogen plant, retooled their plant to make it utilizable for that product, because it handles differently. Its resins are different, and it has a higher ash content for as it goes. But the ecological benefits that come with it, like Kendall pointed out, we are a product, we're a byproduct of a restoration action rather than being a logging operation in and of itself.
Quick question.
Go ahead.
Prairie Wood, is D.R. Johnson still alive?
No.
No, he's not. So his daughter's running the outfit?
His family is.
Very good. Anything further? I'm not.
Could I make a brief comment?
Please.
Judge Perry, Representative Frederick asked about obstacles in the junipers, and I'd like to just hit upon, and these watershed restorations, it's about 10-15% that is of the juniper that's cut for watershed restoration is of value for
commercial use, for no other better term of it. So that's an obstacle. It's not like you, out of a large clear cut, you get a lot of product that is millable. So that to look at other uses for the other than the bowl itself, there's the good thing is there's acres and acres and acres of it. Is it 9 million acres, kings? Yes, something like that. So,
will it hold up to the to heat, like for applications and saunas and that sort of thing?
Yes. Yep. That's one active use. I meant just for fun. I'm also right now going to export some juniper to Sweden.
All right.
For a guy who's making little barrels to age gin.
How about that?
So that means we have a product from here that needs to go worldwide.
Wow. Not only use the juniper berries, we use the wood too. So very good.
What a deal.
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Just a fascinating development here. And thank you for helping develop yet another industry here in Oregon, homegrown and employing Oregonians and taking care of a problem that we have with juniper. With that, I'd like to call up our last witness, Ryan Temple. Good afternoon, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Almost good evening. Thank you very much. It's late for the day. I'm happy to be here, and I appreciate you staying to hear all of us. My name is Ryan Temple. I'm the president of Sustainable Northwest Wood. It's a wholesale distribution yard based in Portland, Oregon. We sell products exclusively from the Pacific Northwest, which means essentially we are moving Oregon wood products into the building trades across the West. As I said at the other committee, the product I am most excited about out of everything that I carry is the potential of juniper right now. Because I was next door and missed what the other panelists said, I fear somewhat being redundant, and so I'll try and keep my comments somewhat brief, and if you have any follow-up questions after mine, I'll let you ask them at that time. Thinking back to the earlier in the day when we were talking about the sage grouse, I mean, the one thing that struck me was, yes, the magnitude of that problem, but the legitimate concerns of how a listing could eliminate jobs in eastern Oregon, and the irony of the activities that could avoid that listing actually create jobs. And of course, what we're talking about here is the juniper restoration. So we really have an opportunity through the utilization and removal of juniper to turn that problem on its head, and I hope we find ways to take advantage of that. And these aren't jobs that are necessarily funded by subsidies. Maybe some subsidies are needed to jumpstart them, but by and large, as we've learned through this talk of utilization, these are jobs that are funded by markets. I can give an example right now of a project that we're working on with Kendall. Logs that were moved in his area, creating jobs for the loggers there. Truckers moving those logs to Kendall's mill. Jobs at Kendall's mill, logging those or milling those down into the boards. Moving those boards down to Hubbard, Oregon, where Trillium Pacific Millwork turns them into paneling. From there, those boards are going to Newburgh, Oregon, where Finish Line Industries is putting a coat of polyurethane on them for final install, which will be at the Portland Airport, where Howard S. Wright Construction has won a contract with Panera Bread, and they're going to be doing juniper paneling in that, and then subsequently several more of their stores. So it is an eastern Oregon story, but it's much more than that. It's not so much about east-west. This is really about Oregon here, and it's spanning both sides of the state. It's creating economic opportunity in all sides of the state. And in a time when forest policy is all too often about east versus west or red versus blue or compromise where everybody walks away from the table thinking, well, we've given something up there, but I guess we're, you know, we did it. This is an opportunity where nobody walks away unhappy. What we have is not just an opportunity for economics and jobs and forest management and restoration to be compatible. They're all closely aligned. As one of these succeeds in this scenario, all of those are going to succeed together. And so that sort of win-win-win situation, to me, is what gets me most excited about juniper. I can talk about the durability of it, and that's great, and the restoration. That's each of those individually is
super.
Put them all together and you've really got something special and something with unlimited opportunity for market growth and for job creation. But there's obstacles to that, and I think that's why we come before you today to talk about, yes, how excited we are all to be doing this, and it is hard work, but small rural businesses face deep challenges in terms of access to capital and resources and technical assistance, sometimes just access to the logs. And so what we ask of you really is anything that you can do to help us overcome those challenges and move this great opportunity forward together.
Mr. Temple, your enthusiasm, your excitement is palpable, and we would love nothing better than to be able to work with your industry to help that grow. It's just a phenomenal opportunities here. And you made a comment that Vice Chair Frederick and I caught each other's eye precisely as you said it, and I suspect he may have a commentary.
I would. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we were on our tour, people kept asking why I was interested in going to Eastern Oregon and why I was interested in going to the forests and to the farms and to the ranches that we were there. You just gave an example of why I'm interested. We have everything that comes out of Oregon often comes through my district. Now, I don't have a ranch or a farm. We have a lot of chickens in my district, but we don't have a lot ranch or farm in my district at this particular point. But the natural resources that come out of the state come through my district. They are, some of them have some processing that takes place. Some of them are just simply transported through on the road, on the railroad, or on the barge, on the river. But they come through there. And we are connected. There is a clear connection between the rest of the state and the metro area. And we've lost that. This may help us recover it. And it is something that I think is one of the most important things we could possibly do. When I was a reporter, I got a chance to spend time with Tom McCall, and just a little bit. And his concern was that many of the families in the metro area no longer had families in the rest of the state, so that there was no connection between the two. And so although they might have caused problems for each other as family, they still had a respect for the kind of work that was being done outside of the Portland metro area. When we start to see this kind of connection with your work and the gin things as well going international, I think we're going to begin to see, I hope that this begins the process of reconnecting the state, reconnecting the people in the state with a knowledge that, in fact, we're all in this together. And a real simple point, we all do better when we all do better.
Yeah.
And I'd really like to make sure that that's the case. So thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
And with, I can think of no better way to close than Representative Vice Chair Frederick's commentary. So thank you very, very much for that observation. And thank you for your enthusiasm about an Oregon-grown industry start to finish.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate that. Is there anything for the good of the order before we adjourn? For those of you who may have looked at the agenda, we were not able to get through it all today. We have a good start on our September hearing. We'll look forward to that. And all I can say is this was an absolutely fascinating set of hearings today. I want to thank all of our panel members for making it as interesting as it was. With that, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much.